You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Today on The Grave Talks, New England Legends. New England legends run far and wide. Stories of cryptic creatures pushing young people off cliffs. Christmas monsters keeping children in line. Ghostly women lingering around cemeteries. The list goes on and on. Being one of the oldest settled parts of the United States, it's not hard to understand why this area is filled with ghost stories and legends that many people believe and experience to this day. Jeff Belanger has been documenting these legends and stories for many years and joins us to talk about some of the most compelling New England legends he's ever uncovered.
So I remember being a kid about 10 years old and living in Newtown, Connecticut, and Sandy Hook specifically. And just two towns away, there was this story that everyone used to talk about the White Lady of Easton. And she's this spectral white figure that had been seen up and down the road right next to Union Cemetery in Easton, which is at this intersection of a couple of major back roads. You know, like if you were, you know, cutting through to Fairf down to the coast or whatever. And it's one of those things where you would happen by it quite a bit because these roads are, you know, pretty significantly traveled. And when you go by, you can't help but look. You can't help but look into the cemetery and say, well, I wonder if tonight's the night that I'll actually see her. So I'm a little kid. I'm 10, 11 years old, and I'm looking out the back window all the way until the cemetery is completely out of sight, just waiting to catch a glimpse of this thing. And that story was so reinforced by Ed and Lorraine Warren, who lived one town away in Monroe. So I lived in the town next to them and two towns from Easton. And so I knew Ed and Lorraine Warren since I was a young kid and heard them tell the story. And I saw this video that Ed showed me once of this apparition he captured there. And I remember looking at it and going, oh man, unless Steven Spielberg helped him with this video, I have no explanation for what it is he captured. You see this white, wispy shape take form into like a person. I would even go so far as to call it feminine looking, like kind of sort of curvy. And it's moving around some headstones, coming toward the camera. And then this black stuff just kind of pulls it down into the ground. The whole thing is about 4 or 5 seconds, but that's a long time. And I just, my jaw's hanging open. I saw the video, and even to this day, if I happen to be driving by that cemetery, you can't help but slow down and look.
When you have something like that, that has the lore around it, that people talk about as the haunted cemetery, but then you actually are able to see some evidence of this being far more than just a legend. What goes through your mind? I mean, what is the history to that legend that makes it so real besides having evidence?
Yeah, that's the great thing, right? So the backstory, and by backstory, I mean definitely legend, is that there was a woman who was killed on her wedding day, and her body was buried behind the church, which is right next to the cemetery, or discarded behind the church, rather. And there's no record of it. We can't find any sort of record of that. And then another version of the story is that it was just this scorned, murdered woman who was buried in the cemetery, and she's kind of like out seeking revenge. And there was a time when women were buried in their wedding dresses. That was common practice. So white lady legends, they're all over England. White ladies, gray ladies, green ladies. And that influence is still felt in New England and really all around the United States. So though they're not as prevalent as Old England, we have our share as well. So that was Connecticut's version, the White Lady of Easton. We don't specifically know her backstory. We do know women used to get buried in wedding dresses. And then you combine that with these firsthand accounts where people say they're driving down the road and they see this woman step into the road and they lock up the brakes and they, oh my God, I just hit a pedestrian or something. And you get out of your car and there's no one there. And you're sure you just hit someone, but nope, it's gone. And then you see the cemetery and you can't help but think of that story. And it goes back. I mean, it goes back, gosh, 60, 70 years at this point. People have been talking about that. And so at some point, the legend becomes as real as the headstones, as the old wrought iron gates, as the land that it's on, because everyone just sort of knows it. And I know that that influences you in some way. Even if we can't say why this ghost was here, it still begs us to ask questions and speculate.
To this day, do you still get people contacting you with a variation of that story where it just happened to them?
Not specifically the White Lady. It's been a long time since I've heard an account from that one, but others, absolutely. It happens all the time because I'm out here doing this all the time every week. You know, I tell stories in front of people. I do the podcast. I write books. I work in television and this is my whole life. And so I've sort of become a magnet for the stories, which by the way is awesome when it's also your job.
Sure.
Because, you know, sometimes your next lead is just in today's email and it's, I appreciate it more than I can ever say. So sometimes people will say, oh my gosh, I was on Catherine's Hill in Cherryfield, Maine, and my car started to go haywire. It started to slow down. And then I started thinking about the headless ghost of Catherine's Hill. And it's one of those things where you go, wow, the legend just got a shot in the arm. It just got a dose of steroids. And they wrote to me, they're probably talking to other people, and suddenly it grows again. And a legend, I've said many times, is a living, breathing thing. It cannot be disputed. It is real. It feeds. It grows. It can go to sleep. It can go dormant. It can move. It can marry others. And it can die. And the only way a legend dies is if we all stop talking about it. There is no other way. You can try to disprove it. You can say, look, I've looked through the historical records. There's no murder victim in Union Cemetery in Easton, Connecticut. There's no, you know, hitchhiker murdered on this stretch of road or whatever. It doesn't matter. As long as people keep having these weird experiences, as long as they tie it to this thing they heard, it becomes very real and very tangible.
When you have legends like that, I mean, it's something I always think about, too, where you hear a story and it sounds almost, you know, too interesting, too good to be true or something of that nature of or it's a variation of one that floats around the country where there's many, obviously, communities have these stories. And until you move out of that community or go beyond that bubble, you think this is unique to my area. And then you discover, oh, my God, every town in America has this story, you know, except it's that road or this road. Like the car being pushed by the bridge or
Gravity
something.
Hill.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Everyone's got one.
We have three in Massachusetts alone.
But you
and,
always...
and I know, and I've been to the one in Texas, which I think started it all. I can't totally prove that, but
really?
It seems to be the earliest reference. And you're right. Yeah, because everyone sort of wants one, mm-hmm. and we can all relate to it. Right. And I think that's part of the reason. It sounds sort of familiar.
We can. And you're almost kind of answering the question I'm going to ask. When it comes to those, I always say, you know, there must be some place where this originates. Finding the origins of these stories obviously is not the easiest thing in the world. And in many cases, probably impossible for some of these at this point, because they go back in some cases more than 100 years with no true way to say, yes, this is where it originated. But that's what I'm always interested in. When you have these legends that people still claim to experience, and some have evidence of experiencing, it's like, well, where did this begin? How did this begin? Tell me about that with the Texas case of the Gravity Hill. How did you trace that back? Where do you believe, or how do you believe that that is where that may have began?
It was one of those things where it's just the earliest written record that I could find, you know, and I can't promise it's the first, but it's the one that everyone seems to sort of point to. And the story goes, and I forget which town, gosh, what it was, but there are these train tracks, and a school bus full of children pull up on the train tracks, and the bus stalls, and the train's coming, and there's no time to get out. And tragically, the train hits the bus, and all the children die. It's so horrible. It's so terrible. And to this day, if you put your car in neutral by those train tracks, the car will seemingly be pushed uphill against gravity and over and through the train tracks to safety. And if you want to test it, if you can take talcum powder and you can put it all over the trunk of your car before you do this, and then go ahead and wait, watch the car get pushed up over to safety, and then go look at your trunk, and what you'll see are dozens of these little tiny fingerprints of the children that just pushed your car to safety. And the crazy thing, Tony, is it works. I've tried it.
And it turns out there's a pack of children that live in a tree stump nearby, and they go and help every night.
So what it turns out is that I've done the talcum powder.
Okay.
And I've done these. I did the one. There was one in Massachusetts. The variation of the story, it's in the Berkshires of Massachusetts, is this is right under an overpass of Route 2. And the story goes that a school bus full of children went over the overpass and died on impact when it hit the road below, going off the bridge from above. Mm-hmm. And if you put your car in neutral right there in that spot, it will be pushed to safety so the bus doesn't hit you, so you're not hit. And it does seemingly look uphill. And I did the talcum powder, and there were dozens of fingerprints all over the trunk of the car. And so that one, sadly, we can't explain with science. Those would be my fingerprints, because every time I close the trunk of the car, I'm leaving fingerprints on them, and talcum powder is just bringing them out, right? Unless you just had your car washed and waxed, then you probably won't see any fingerprints. But that reinforces the story. And then the other part of it is it's a bit of an optical illusion. It turns out there's a slight dip in the road right before the bridge, and it's just enough that if you put your car in neutral, you'll start to pick up a little bit of momentum and then go up the hill right in, you know, right underneath the bridge, same as the one in Texas. And it all works the same. That Texas story, there's no record of a school bus getting hit by a train. I mean, that's the kind of thing that would actually be talked about forever.
Sure.
You know, I mean, because when big tragedies like that happen, we never forget. I mean, communities never forget. There's memorials placed there. I mean, if truly a school bus full of children was killed, there would be like markers with all the names and all kinds of things to commemorate that, because that's just a horrible thing that we would want to commemorate.
Sure.
But it doesn't matter, because with this legend, and really with all of them, I think they stick around because it's like a sermon from our past, and we need it for some reason that we may not fully understand at the time. So that one is, you know, hey, train tracks are dangerous. Overpasses are dangerous. You need to pay attention when you're driving. You need to stay awake. You need to be alert. You shouldn't be stopping your car underneath a bridge or right by a train track. It's a bad idea. So maybe we keep telling each other this story as a reminder that, you know, though that school bus full of children was not, you know, they weren't killed right here in this spot, it could happen to you in your car. People do get hit by trains. Cars do stall out, and tragedies do happen. So we tell those stories to remind us to be a little bit vigilant, especially in dangerous places.
Cautionary tales for children. I mean, it really is, and it's almost done subconsciously. I mean, if you just tell a person, okay, don't stop on the train track, don't play in the train track, that's one thing. But if you can follow that up with, and by the way, a bus of children were all, you know, slaughtered here, that makes it a little more impactful. That makes you think twice.
It does. It hits you. And not only that, in England, there's, like I said, there's gray ladies and green ladies and white ladies. One story that gets told a lot is, you know, castle ruins are haunted by the gray lady, and you got to stay away from there because if she catches you, she'll kill you. And it's a story parents are all too happy to tell their children over and over again, because playing in castle ruins is dangerous. You could fall. Those stones could fall on top of you. It's not really a safe place. So sometimes those ghosts appear or something weird happens, and then it gets reinforced by telling the story over and over again, because that gray lady ghost is actually keeping your children safe.
It's interesting. And that's very geographic specific to castle ruins. You know, in America, obviously, we don't have many castle ruins that we need to put a cautionary tale out to children for. Maybe soon we'll have, you know, some sort of version of that for shopping centers. Don't go to the haunted Kmart. You know?
Well, we do have one. There's one in Massachusetts. He's called the Monster of Coca-Cola Ledge.
Really?
And oh, it's so good. It's in North Adams, Massachusetts, and it's called Coca-Cola Ledge because there's this big cliff face. Probably it's got to be like 100 feet at least, you know, maybe 150 feet. And it overlooks the whole town. And in the 1950s, the Coca-Cola company painted a big old billboard right on the side of the cliff. So it was just kind of dubbed Coca-Cola Ledge after that. It's very easy to get to the top because it's a very gentle slope on either side. So if you picture like a, you know, a hillside, you know, you can very easily walk to the top. And the creature people have described up there is, by all accounts, a Bigfoot creature, a big, tall, hairy creature. It smells bad, it's loud, and it's dangerous. And they tell that story because if you go to that cliff today, you see tons of Greek letters painted into the cliff from local fraternities at the college. So people are risking their lives to spray paint and deface the cliff to this very day. And if you fall from that cliff, you will not get injured. I promise you, you're going to die. Like, that's a one-way ticket. It's too high. And so that's another story that parents tell their kids. But at the same time, there have been Bigfoot sightings in the Berkshires. So I think it gets reinforced by actual legit witnesses. And then you put it into this dangerous place. And it's another reason to tell your kids, look, you can go up there if you want, but there's a monster.
Yeah.
And maybe you should think twice, or at least be cautious if you are up there.
It's kind of off our topic, but I want to ask us, since we're talking about legends and the geography of some of them, an interesting one that you hear in other parts of the world would be that of a cautionary tale, Krampus, being something that is quite popular in other parts of the world. But in America, never been quite one that's caught on, you know, other
yet.
Than in modern.
Yet, Tony.
Yet, you're correct. Yet. In more modern times, last 10 years, it's getting a little more traction than it's had in quite some time. But I wonder about that. It's truly just a cautionary tale of being a well-behaved child. That's the main thing. We're not connecting it to geography or a cliff or anything like that. It's just don't be an asshole.
Well, but you know what, though? Like, the Pennsylvania Dutch country has the Belschnickel.
Okay.
And the Belschnickel is really like Krampus light, right? So Krampus, for those who might be lost for the moment, Krampus comes December 5th, and he is not the enemy or nemesis of Santa Claus. He's a cohort. They are partners. Good cop, bad cop. Krampus is bad cop. So Krampus comes in, and he snatches up all the bad children and takes them back to his lair, and he kills them. So on St. Nicholas Day, December 6th, St. Nicholas is free to bring presents to all the good kids because there's no bad children left. Krampus took care of it. And it started in Germany, and it's a great story. It's been made into a Hollywood movie. The Belschnickel literally means Nicholas in furs, and it's still popular in Pennsylvania Dutch country. He comes around anytime between like days and weeks before Christmas, and he's dressed in fur, and he carries a switch of sticks, and he's covered in soot on his face. And each community, this year could be your year to be the Belschnickel. So you would go to my house and you'd knock on the door and you'd say, Jeff, do you have any naughty children here who need to meet with me? And I'd say, yeah, little Johnny over here has really been a pain in the ass this past year. And you'd say, okay. And you'd take Johnny to the backyard, tie him to a tree and beat him with sticks. All dressed as the Belschnickel. And Johnny now has a couple of weeks to get right and get some presents for Christmas.
It's interesting that this is not caught on as being a real popular thing, you know?
You haven't been at my house at Christmas. We have Krampus in the corner. We've got Belschnickel coming daily. I mean, you know, I'm doing my part, but I'm only one guy.
You know, it's almost like there is a super, you know, light version of Krampus, almost encompassed into the American version of Santa, which would really just be the little book that he writes into, where it's like, he's watching you. There's no incarnation of Krampus. There's no incarnation outside of, you know, that legend of the Belschnickel. But for most, it's just a little book that we've condensed this down to. I remember as a child, I guess I was acting up, and my parents thought it'd be a great way to get me to shape up. They had an uncle dress as Santa Claus, show up outside of my bedroom window one morning when I was getting ready for school and sit on a rock and just write in a little black book and then go away. And that was
Awesome. That is so good.
I'm like, wow, that's really a length to go to try. Like, I thought I was a pretty good kid. But yeah, it was. So I guess it's a little bit more understated. It's more passive aggressive of an approach.
Yeah, you're totally right. And Tony, since, I mean, we're so far off topic now, but why not? Let me get in one shameless plug. We're almost finished with a documentary I did for PBS called Creepy Christmas. And it's all about Belschnickel and Krampus and the Tomten of Sweden and Iceland, Yule lads, and all these wonderful creatures that are the darker side of the holiday. And it's going to come out this December. So it's funny. We're filming the last few scenes just next week. So anyway, there's that to look forward to.
We are going to have to talk about that in the coming months because just last year I was like, there's like so little Christmas content that's out there involving paranormal. I mean, there's like little nuggets here and there. I happen to find a couple good interviews this year about it, but we're gonna have to definitely talk about that because that would be very interesting. Get closer to that. So back to what we're talking about with New England legends. Let's pull it back. Although
Merry Christmas, Tony.
Exactly. Although the one you were referencing earlier, you know, we're talking about in old Dutch country in Pennsylvania that kind of stays in our area. When we're talking about the legends that are out there, was there any that you came across in your research that you had heard of or had found out as just being this legend story and thought, wow, that's a good one. You know, if it were true, that would be pretty amazing if people actually found evidence of it, as they have with the graveyard you spoke of earlier. Was there anywhere you started digging into and then found out, oh, there is more to this than just the legend?
All right. I'm going to tell you a story. This was actually last week's podcast episode of my New England Legends weekly podcast. Okay. And it's the story of Ephraim Gray, and he's called the Immortal Mad Scientist of Malden, Massachusetts, which is just great, right? So the story goes, in 1850, there's this reclusive guy that lives near the center of town, and he lives in his house only with a manservant, never been married, no children. And at night, he does these experiments, and this strange, horrible smelling smoke comes out of his windows, and the neighbors don't quite like him. And when he is seen in town, they might try to engage him or say hello, but he just grunts and keeps walking, and no one wants to talk to him. And then one day in 1850, he passes away, and his manservant opens the front door and is told he's to inherit everything, but he has two instructions. Number one, he's allowed to say what his master has been up to all these years. And that was that Ephraim Gray was working on an elixir to make him immortal and live forever. And he said, you know, he was getting close. He tried all different kinds of cocktails on himself. And sadly, Father Time just caught up to him before he actually perfected his elixir. And the second stipulation is that Ephraim Gray is to be buried today, right now. No embalming, no service, no funeral, straight to the boneyard and placed in a crypt. And so he did. He carried that out and put him in a crypt. Fast forward 20 years, students from the Harvard Medical School in 1870 hear this story because it never quite goes away. So they go in the middle of the night to the crypt and they crack it open and they see that Ephraim Gray's body has not decomposed one bit. They said, my gosh, it looks like he's been in here 20 minutes, let alone 20 years. And satisfied that maybe he was onto something, they close the crypt and that's that, and they go back to school. Now we jump ahead to 1900, and Malden, which was this little sleepy town just north of Boston, is now expanding quite a bit because Boston is sprawling out. And so to make room for the town and build new roads, they have to move the whole cemetery. And as the workers are breaking down the crypt, they look in the casket, and Ephraim Gray is gone. Now, some people in town say he perfected his immortality elixir and he walked out. He just walked out of his grave. Skeptics are pretty quick to say, no, 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 those Harvard kids, they must have snatched his body, taken it back, dissected it to figure out exactly what was going on. And of course, there'd be no record of that because body snatching is not something that, you know, this is Harvard. We're not talking about Yale or Princeton. I mean, Harvard people don't snatch bodies. So that story just kind of keeps circulating over and over. Edward R. Snow, who's like he's a legend himself for documenting these weird stories, God, 60, 80 years ago, writes about it, and it just keeps circulating. And so I really dug into this, and I said, all right, there's a book that's available through the archives of all the marriages, births, and deaths of Malden, Massachusetts from like 1760 to like, you know, 1880. And I looked, and there are Gray families. There are people named Ephraim, but there was no Ephraim Gray. And so there's no Ephraim Gray buried. There's no headstone. There's no record of him at all in the town of Malden. And I'm like, oh, what a neat story. That must be the end of it. But then I kind of expanded my search a little bit, and suddenly I find in the 1850 census record, Ephraim A. Gray of Essex, Massachusetts, which is just 20 miles northeast of Malden. It's not far at all. And in 1850, it says he's a shoemaker. He lives with no other people. There's no children or anything like that. And a shoemaker would have chemicals for tanning, right? For tanning leathers and preserving this, you know, the leathers and all that other stuff. And you go, that's really weird. So there was an Ephraim Gray not far from Malden who was working with leather and shoes, so preserving things. And suddenly you go, maybe this is the right guy, but the wrong town, right story. And then the mind-blowing moment happens as I'm going through. I mean, I go through Ancestry. I go through, like, you know, Family Search, all these things. And it says he was born in 1827 in upstate New York. And then there's his record. It says Ephraim A. Gray, 1827, dash, nothing. There's nothing after the dash. and I go, oh, my God, that means one of two things. One, they have no record of his death. Or two, he didn't die. I have screenshots of it. I saved everything. It's so awesome. And as far as I know, no one ever bothered to look outside of Malden. So there was always just people that have looked into the story in the past have always just said, yeah, wow, it's just a great story, you know. But man, oh, man, 20 miles away, there might be some Ephraim Gray still walking around to this day.
He's out in the woods and no one knows. Wow. That's
blending in, immortal.
With the, obviously, the internet and ways that we can look up stories now. We were talking a little bit earlier about legends. They don't die. They have their own life. The only way they die is if we stop talking about them. Has there been any legends that have resurfaced, essentially, that you've come across because of the internet? Maybe they had died, you know, because people had stopped talking about them, and unless you went into found an old book or something where it had an account of it, no one would be speaking of it. But with the internet, maybe somebody finally speaks up and goes, hey, I remember my grandmother told me the story 40 years ago, but that was the last of it, and then suddenly it catches back on again in recent years.
Yeah, well, quick comment on the role of the internet. So folklore works the same way today as it did 200, 300, 400 years ago. It just moves a lot faster because of the internet. Mm-hmm. But the function of it is the same. Someone hears a story, and there's enough in there that makes you think, I don't necessarily believe it, but there's something in there that rings true enough that you'll pass it on. If a story's so ludicrous, if I said, like, hey, the ghost of Elvis is dancing with the Loch Ness Monster in Faneuil Hall in Boston, you're going to say, like, yeah, that's dumb. I'm not even going to repeat that. There's no precedent for that. Elvis wasn't from there. Loch Ness is in Scotland. What's wrong with you, right? You're crazy. It has to sound believable enough. It has to hit some literal nerve inside your body for you to say, that sounds crazy. However, I'm going to tell someone else about this because, man, oh, man, it's too good. Or it might even drive you to go check it out for yourself. So that's still happening, but now people are posting it on Twitter and Facebook, mm-hmm. and so on. And as I mentioned, I'm getting so many leads for my stories now from our Facebook group, from emails, where they'll say, like, hey, you uncovered this nugget. And I had heard a story growing up about that very thing. So one story that keeps coming up lately is our stories of witches. And a lot of towns have these old history books, and many of them have been digitized and are on archive.org or Google Books or whatever. And they're free for you to go read them, the whole thing. And these old historians from like the mid 1800s meticulously wrote down everything they could about the previous century of their little town's history. And I found in many different towns, there's stories of witches, and the witches have specific names. It was, you know, Goody Cole, or it was so-and-so who lived here, and she was a ward of the town, and she hexed this neighbor. And they give names, they give addresses, they give places. It's not just general, like, spooky stuff. It's like, no, this person was thought to be a witch. And keep in mind, this is post 1692 Salem. So we don't necessarily execute these people anymore, because that was a disaster and no one wants to be part of that after 1692. So, but at the same time, there were still witch hunts per se, but it was more about horrible gossip that would absolutely destroy a person or a family by accusing them of witchcraft. And it often happened to older women who might be widowed and didn't have children. If you're a woman who's a widow and you don't have any kids, you're not allowed to own land. You officially become a ward of the town, and you're at the mercy of your neighbors to take care of you, to provide food and firewood and everything for you. And as you can imagine, sometimes neighbors don't want to do it, and they get mad about it. And then the woman gets mad about it. And then she starts to get a reputation of being a witch. And some of them would use that reputation to get what they needed. So if you think I'm a witch, fine. I'll put a spell on you if you don't bring me extra firewood. Okay, settle down. I don't need a hex on me or my family. You know, looks like your wife was baking today. You better bring me a pie, or there's going to be a curse on your house. All right, I'll bring you a pie. You know, I mean, so they were doing this. And suddenly these witch stories seem to be coming up more and more in the last couple of years, because the term witch hunt is thrown around like confetti by every politician we have.
Sure.
On every side of the issue, no matter where you stand, it's always a witch hunt. I'm innocent. It's just a witch hunt. People are just accusing me of something, you know, that I didn't do. And so we have thrown that term around, and suddenly all these witch trials, all these witch stories are relevant again. Because we do have witch hunts. You have witch hunts in your local PTA. You know, there's witch hunts in your small town, you know, elections. And there's witch hunts nationally and internationally. It's relevant. And when you look at the stories, and when you repeat those old legends from the small towns, you go, wow, man, we haven't changed in 200 years, which is comforting and horrible at the same time.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Jeff Belanger about New England legends. In part two, what makes people believe folklore that they find on social media? Is society starting to lose their compass for judgment of fact versus fiction? What's one of the most disturbing New England legends or ghost stories Jeff Belanger has come across? How true is the story of the Lizzie Borden haunting and crime? Can a location that may not be truly haunted by what a legend tells later become infested with activity due to the energy of those seeking it out? Has there been a legend that Jeff desperately wanted to believe that had factual basis, turned out to have no historical evidence at all? And what shocking evidence did Jeff find relating to the accuracy of the Conjuring story? All that and more in part two of our interview. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.